My name is Stefan Sasse, and for the second time, I can introduce not one, but two guests from the realm of political expertise and consulting, who will now introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Marcus Roberts. I'm the head of international politics for YouGov, the global data and polling firm.
Hey everyone, I'm Frank Spring. I am a managing partner of Undaunted Ventures, a consulting firm that uses behavioral science insights for persuasion and performance for clients in nonprofits, politics, and advocacy.
Thank you for joining us once again. We did an episode like 3 months back, approximately, where we talked about the process of politics, basically. And today I want to get a little bit more into the weeds on this and mainly talk about framing and political language, basically. And I want to start with a little overview of current events here in Germany, because if you don't know, we have a campaign going on in September. There will be elections for our parliament, which is called the Bundestag. And of course, you have campaigning season and a lot of dumb shit is getting said, and a lot of dumb shit is dominating the headlines. And my question is basically, how are voter perceptions how are they formed by the language that people use? So for example, everyone has for their favorite party or not favorite party, you have a certain idea. They have a reputation, you know, two or three words that are just associated with them. So, for example, the CDU is stability, the SPD is solidarity, the Greens are something with the environment, the AfD is something migration, and so on and so forth. So how does this actually happen? How can you use your language in order to get such a reputation or not?
So I think, I mean, one way to think of it is, first, political parties, like corporations over decades, develop specific brands, and some of that is developed. Some of that is deliberate, and so, by deliberate choice in how they communicate and how they use language to communicate their interests. And some of that is just a function of how events affect them. So there are corporate brands in the world that are defined not by a marketing campaign, but by an event that occurred to them in a specific generation. So an example for this, and I promise I'll bring this back to political parties in a second. But an example for this would be, there are people for whom the oil company, the extraction company Exxon, will forever be associated with a massive oil spill off the coast of Alaska. This is like, that event is now just associated with that corporate brand. There's not a whole lot they can do to get around that, although it has not affected their bottom line particularly in the last 20 years. So, you know, political parties that have been around a long time maintain surprisingly durable brands. And I think we sort of lose track of that tendency. The Democratic Party has had what you might charitably call a pretty uneven 20 years, but remains, from a strictly kind of brand perspective, one of the strongest brands in America. It's been around in its present incarnation for rising 80 years, and while there are and it has a surprisingly durable base, if you want to think of it in consumer terms. So how do you use but at the same time, this is not simply a phenomena, parties. Party brand identification isn't simply a phenomena, isn't simply a result of what happens to them over decades. They can control it. And there are a few ways that they can do it. I want to hand over to Marcus in a second because I've been going on too long already. But, you know, there is value in simplicity and clarity and repetition. One of the problems that some political parties have, and the Democratic Party has certainly been responsible, I'll speak to that experience because I can't speak to the German political experience with any knowledge. One of the challenges for the Democratic Party has been, we have not had simplicity on our side for most of my adult political life. There's a notion that if you repeat the same thing, if you repeat three things to someone three times, they will remember one of them. The problem for the Democratic Party in the past 20 years has been a tendency to slip into saying our platform is nine different things. So rather than repeating three things three times to our chosen audience, we say nine things once. And as a result, it just sounds like a cacophony and no one remembers who we are, and we don't end up with a strong brand identification. So people end up with this, I don't know what the Democratic Party stands for, which is very much an attitude you encounter in undecided and unmotivated audiences.
Yeah, I really agree with that. I think that we tie ourselves up in knots sometimes in the quest for magic words in politics. believing that somehow if we can just find the perfectly focused group phrase that then resonates through our quant testing, take it back to qual for some modification in subgroups, take it back to quant for a final verification, we'll then have a message tested series of magic words that Frank Luntz or Thomas Frank would agree with and say is the solution. And I don't think politics is that. I think that we salivate over get Brexit done or build the wall or make America great again as right-wing series of magic words. And we ask, why can't we have left-wing equivalents? But what we're actually doing is we're focusing on a tree instead of understanding a forest. Those words work because they tap into broader swathes and streams of public opinion at that time. If they didn't have those words and they were still focusing on those issues in those ways to those audiences at that time, they would still be highly electorally successful. Maybe there were even better words out there somewhere that could have resulted in even better effects. I don't know. But I think we make a mistake when we fetishize the soundbite and we lose track of the politics itself. And this comes back to a bigger point that is kind of the fundamental point of my current political philosophy, if I can be so grand as to say that, which is the right is simply better at resonating with the public more often. The left is simply worse at resonating with the public more often. More often, the left, be it in Germany, be it in the UK, be it in the US, be it in Australia, is out of kilter with public opinion on most of the main issues of the day come an election. Sometimes that is not the case. And when that is not the case, and the left also has a credible, strong leader, they're able to win the election. But most of the time, the left's default position is, we are of the left, and we are here to tell you the ways in which you, the voter, are wrong. You, the voter, need to apologize for Trump. You, the voter, need to apologize for Brexit. You, the voter, need to apologize for the way that you voted in your last domestic election for the right. And until you apologize, we really shouldn't have anything to do with you. The right, meanwhile, doesn't give a damn about your ideological position or how you voted last time. They just want your vote. And they're prepared to go out and get it. And they're even prepared to go out and say things and do things and even spend money when they're in government on things that they don't agree with. And as a consequence, they're able to align more closely with the voter. Rather than focus on the problem of a disconnect between a party and an electorate, what we in the left often end up doing is talk about the disconnect between the words and the voter, because that seems like a more easy, more manifest, more tangible, more solvable problem. But I actually think it's taking us away from the root cause.
Some of this, I think, Marcus, I couldn't agree more. And I think a lot of this is the legacy of George Lakoff, who I don't want to particularly throw stones at. But for those of your listeners who may not know him, George Lakoff is an American a communications expert, and he's written several books on particularly political strategic communication. His most famous is probably Don't Think of an Elephant. And his whole argument is essentially an earlier version of what I said about the simplicity of framing. And his argument was the Democratic Party was beaten bloody in the 80s because the Republican Party had a strong issue set. They had a strong national defense, low taxes, small government. Everyone knew what the Republican Party stood for. And he's not wrong about that. That brand and kind of the values it represents are still pretty durable. And his argument was the Democratic Party needs to come up with our own three message set. We're for, secure families and, safe communities and whatever, right? Like, we'll just get these three messages, we'll get them together, and we'll just keep hammering them home. And the problem with this is...
Yeah, remember when Lakoff was going to make all taxes Social Security payments?
That's right. That's exactly. A lot of his diagnoses, I think, are right, because if you say nine different things once to people, it does just sound like a chaos. But if your whole idea is the solution to this is we're going to get those three things, secure families, safe communities, and, giant pies or whatever his third option was for the Democratic Party platform. And we're really going to get that out. And once we trot those three things out and say those things ruthlessly, then we will be saved. Is an example of what Marcus was just talking about. It prioritizes figuring out the right words as opposed to thinking, like, what stories are our audience telling themselves? What do they believe? What story are we telling about ourselves and the country? How resonant are they, and how can we bring those things into greater alignment, which is not a messaging question at all.
Yeah, that brings me to my major point for today, because I think we have a big problem of narrative, basically. Because as you said, we have stories on the right that resonate with voters. You know, like build the wall to keep out the immigrants. That's and the immigrants are at fault. That is a story that everyone can grasp and makes immediate sense, even if it doesn't on the merits. But if you hear it, it makes sense. And what drives me nuts as a German lefty, basically, is European policy and financial policy, basically. And the great story that the right has been telling for literally decades now, is this a story of they are the responsible adults, you know, they keep the purse clamped shut against wasteful spending and irrational spending and all of that. We in Germany, we have a name for it, a narrative that has evolved in the last 15 years, which is called the Schwarze Null, the Black Zero, for a balanced budget, basically. And it is such a brilliant piece of narration and of framing. And then you had the latest European discourses over budget, where you had the Frugal Four, which is another brilliant piece of framing. Like, who doesn't want to be frugal, right? This is a virtue. You instantly see grandma, how she's holding everything together. And there is nothing like this on the left. I mean, what are we talking about? You know, the spirit of European solidarity and some such. And none of that connects anywhere. But of course, the answer can't be for the left to slash the welfare state and to follow the Black Zero. So we need a story that resonates. And my question is, when I heard about the MMT theory, I don't know if you know it, you know, modern monetary theory, this general idea that the state is not financed by taxes, but rather by printing money, and taxes are used to control inflation, which has some traction on some parts on the left. Bernie Sanders's advisors, Stephanie Kelton, is a proponent of this. And I don't have any clue of the economic merits of this. But when I heard about it, I thought this could be what the Laffer curve was for Republicans. You know, it is a story about an economic theory that you can actually explain and with which you can legitimize anything. You know, like when Republicans started saying, and conservatives all over the world, like, if we slash taxes, we will have more money. This doesn't make any sense whatsoever, but it's such a strong story because it's what people like to hear, basically. You know, we don't have to change anything, you will be better off, and we can do all these things. And if the left was able, instead of saying, like, we need to raise taxes on certain groups, which are then a problem to define, or we need to cut down our consumption of this or our consumption of that, and we need to do this very considerate monetary policy. If we just said, we have the damn money, modern monetary theory explains it all, next issue. You know, would that work? Or am I on the wholly wrong track here?
It would only work if the public wanted to do it anyway. So whatever your magic MacGuffin words are, is once again far less important than tapping into that public opinion position. Which is not to say that you can't at times use words and stories, as I think we talked a little bit about last time, to lead as well as to respond to public opinion. And once again, the remarkable transformation between 2004 and gay marriage bans in American politics at state level referenda, and 2012, where equal marriage is arguably one of the reasons why the Obama coalition was able to gain re-election and reassembly. These transformations in society and in politics can happen. Political leadership and messaging and story can make a difference. The ability of the liberal left during the 8 years between 2004 and 2012 to tell a story about equal marriage that was more about love than it was about prejudice, I think had a tremendously powerful effect in transforming hearts and minds. And we really have a lot of lessons to learn from it. And I really commend in this respect Sasha Eisenberg's new book on the struggle for equal marriage, which is an excellent meditative reflection on both the limits and possibilities of messaging and words. But when it comes to your point, Stefan, about the right spending and the what was it, the black zero, the Schweine Null. I mean, I love that so much. It's so dark and evil and all consuming.
Yeah, but definitely my favorite episode of Babylon 5.
Oh yes, I mean Richard Hannay and the Schweizerstein of the 39 steps. It's glorious in a kind of really evil way. But the point here is not that their Laffer curve persuades any voter of anything. The point is, there is a piece of common sense that they're tapping into, which is, if we cut your taxes, you will have more money.
Yeah, that's what I mean, basically. You know, I mean, voters want stuff funded. You know, there's always something that people want that parties propose. And I feel that a lot of times the problem is that when the left offers to do stuff like, let's say, environmental protections, etc., you know, if you poll them in the abstract, everyone is for them. But as soon as you put the question like, would you want your taxes to go up for it? The answer is, of course, no. And I have the feeling that the right managed, at least most of the times, I have the feeling that the right managed to basically get around the question entirely with this voodoo economics, more or less. You know, they do not have to answer this question. And for two reasons. One is their reputation. That they basically are the responsible party. So if the CDU offers a new social program, the assumption is just basically that it is a good, thought-out, and financed policy. Whereas when the SPD offers something, the assumption is that it is wasteful spending because of the reputations. And then you have the added problem of explaining it.
I mean, I'll push back a little bit and then I'll tag Frank in, which is I think that we go way overboard in trying to find an explanation for where the money comes from for anything almost at any time. I think it ends up in massive amounts of Excel spreadsheet detail, which is not how voters think, and it's let alone how voters feel, and certainly not how voters decide. One of the reasons I'm certain that Elizabeth Warren's campaign tanked in the polls, having held what seemed to be a death grip on the Democratic nomination for so very long, was she finally ended up answering the question of how she was going to pay for Medicare for All. I think there's any number of parallel universes in which she becomes the nominee, having never explained how she was going to pay for it. Instead, your position becomes we're in a period of unprecedented economic growth. Of course, we can afford to be that little bit generous to those in need. Next issue. Or if it's the reverse, we're in a period of unprecedented economic crisis. Now is the time that we make important priorities that will help move the economy forward to get in the future. And we know that healthcare is one of them. Move the question forward. I think that the quest for arguments beyond that can often create more problems than good. But I'd be interested in Frank's thoughts here.
Sure. Your point about us explaining where progressive parties explaining where the money comes from could not be more accurate. If you recall, the way that Obama was going to fund his entire agenda, which was not particularly detailed to start with in terms of what he was actually going to do, the way he was going to fund it was by repealing the Bush tax cuts. And then every successive promise we made during the period of the Democratic Party's resurgence in the late part of the first decade of the century was always, we're going to, and even 2006, starting in 2006, we're going to repeal the Bush tax cuts. Everything is paid for by repealing the Bush tax cuts. No one had any clue how big the Bush tax cuts were, how much money this was actually, or what we were going to do. But the point was, what was this about? This was about W. This was about attacking W. We're going to pay for this by punching George W. Bush in the face. And there was an audience for that because he left his presidency. He's one of the least popular presidents in American history at the time. Oh, little did we know how bad it could get. So, but back to the Laffer curve on this, because I think you're onto something about the way that the Republican Party was able to find a complex sounding label, because there was a time when that party wanted to at least be seen to have some intellectual coherence. That time has passed, but there's a time when they wanted to be seen to have some intellectual coherence. And it was a handy way of expressing a very simple story. And think about the characters in that particular story. Who are the stories in the Laffer curve story? Entrepreneurs, energetic, hopeful, the American story, people who found things and build things, and work hard and through the work of their brains and muscles are able to build great things. And who is their enemy? A faceless bureaucrat from Washington holding them down through taxes. These are tropes, right? The right uses tropes incredibly effectively. And a trope is a cliche that has not become useless yet. So trope is a recurrent character or a recurrent phenomenon that everyone understands. It's a heuristic, right? The world is complex. We think like we're looking for familiar characters to kind of make sense of what's happening. And the Laffer curve has a couple of great tropes. It's got the bright-eyed entrepreneur, and it's got the tax man holding him down. And that's really all the Laffer curve is just saying this is a phenomenon that occurs. And then there's, another 150 pages of gibberish to back this thing up. And the right, the left is just as capable, if we wanted to, of slapping a marginally academic label on a good narrative. We just tend not to do that because we feel like we have to explain where the money comes from.
And for example, the left has, since the creation of our healthcare systems in the 1940s onwards, always indulged in its own healthcare-related messaging scam in this respect. So when the UK's National Health Service was established, a phenomenal budget was proposed for its first year of 1948, and then a much smaller budget was projected for 1949 and an even smaller budget for 1950. Why? Because there would be fewer sick people. And as there are fewer sick people in society, the cost would go down. The left loves to do this, and why not? So every time we propose pre-distribution of wealth, every time we propose prevention, we say we'll spend some here and we'll save some over there. But in the history of preventative and pre-distributive spending, and the Scandinavians are really good examples of this, there has never been an instance in which, as a consequence, the other budget has come down. What you do is you find other ways of doing other spending, or you expand the spending because now you're into even harder to reach groups. And that's great. And that's good. And I'm not even saying don't make that argument. After all, it works. But I am saying that it would be, I think, disingenuous of us to say that the left does not engage in these same messaging tricks when we can get away with it and when they are successful as well.
When we do it, it's not because we have some sort of moral objection to it. It's that we're not good at it. So we periodically try and fail. But yeah, on the healthcare side, and we should keep making that argument because next time we might be right. You never know. We're due. We're 70 years into it and we're due, boys.
It works for the right, right? Next time we cut taxes, it will definitely unleash growth and revenue. Next time, wait for it. Why shouldn't we do it? Yeah, that's the whole point of my argument with MMT as well. I'm using this rather cynically. Again, I have no clue if this works, but I think it is a potent messaging tool because you can just avoid answering the damn question. You just put it off the magical left curve, in this case, the magical MMT mechanism, and you just say, there, we got it covered. We can finance it. Everything works out. It is just good. And don't worry. Basically.
Which is probably why the right got there first and defined MMT as magic money
trick. Yes, of course.
In order to kill it while still a sapling.
Yeah, absolutely. And why did they? Because they're good at it. That is my whole point from the beginning, right? The right is so much better at this stuff, at least currently, than the left is. I'm not quite sure if the tables were reversed. I would argue like in the 50s, 60s, maybe early 70s, that it was the other way around, in which the right really didn't have anything to put out against the classic Keynesian economics of planning and growth and stuff. But since then, they got their tools, and we haven't found much. The thing you described, attacking the Bush tax cuts and all, this is great, and I think they could do the same thing with the Trump tax cuts. They tried in the campaign, but not very forcefully. this seems to me more like a stopgap measure, basically, because it requires an action. It's basically a reaction to something that the right did before. You know, it is not going on the offensive with your own story. You are just punching back against the stupid story of George W. Bush's, like, our tax cuts for the wealthy will unleash the economic growth. And
But Stefan, that was how. Sorry to interrupt, but I mean, Frank's point was exactly the opposite, in that that was how we were going to get around the how to pay for it in order to do all of the good stuff we wanted. So it wasn't just like let's play defense on it. Let's rather use a mistake that they've made in order to magic wand away all of the problems of how we pay for our own more positive agenda.
Yeah, what I mean is more like I would have us more often in the position to make those mistakes, you know, to be basically the one that they need to react to, rather than having their mistakes as an opportunity for us, you know, because my feeling at least is that they are on the offense much more often. But I see it, your skeptical faces, that I'm on the wrong track.
Well, no, I don't necessarily think you're wrong. It's you have to be in government to have done things to force them to be in reaction mode, and you know, and as a result, it may be just, again, I'm looking at this too much in the American context. And in the British context, where it's been quite some time since Labour has been in government and in a position to do something to which the Conservatives have to react. But, you know, I think the question, if your idea is we should be more aggressively and positively asserting some kind of structural political argument, or better yet, a story to which they have to react, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, one of the things that we're struggling with in this country is there's a clear narrative that I think has actually taken hold, not just on the left, but on the right, or has the potential to take hold, which, you know, among other things, is the Republican Party has, is infiltrated and bedeviled by insurrectionists and criminals, many of them sex criminals, who are in the pockets of an increasingly small number of extremely wealthy individuals. And that last bit there, that the money is going to the wrong people, I think that was sort of the centerpiece of two major presidential campaigns, Warren's and Sanders, both of which punched above their weight in 2016 and then in 2020. Although you could make the argument that Warren's campaign, as Marcus has made, I think quite well, duffed it through a series of strategic and tactical errors. But if your narrative is that America is becoming a plutocracy, a small number of extremely wealthy people who are propping up these increasingly deranged degenerates. That's a multi-part narrative, but it is particularly that first part, the money is going to the wrong people, the plutocrats are at it again, there's your trope. That's a narrative, and you can build a complete politics around that and advance a complete politics around that. The problem is we are, for various reasons, the Democratic Party, we can get into those reasons if you'd like, for various reasons, the Democratic Party is hesitant to get into that kind of material and class-based narrative. With a full throat and a particularly well planned out narrative. So if you know there is a way to be more aggressive with our politics and force the right to play defense, and we have sort of done that, but we haven't quite cohered around it for various structural reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree. Like, the left has been the worst players of the economic populism game of the 21st century, which is kind of astonishing considering that we invented it. So definitely where you see political energy throughout the 21st century in Western politics is where the left has managed to tap in successfully to economic populism and hasn't ceded that ground either to incumbent right-wing governments or to the far right in opposition, which is then able to either win in inverted commas an election in 2016 in America or force a Brexit referendum through or what have you. But so there's definitely, Frank is right, a source of energy there with regard to kleptocracy and the way in which the deal, as Frank has sometimes talked about, is broken. But the other bit, and this is really interesting to me as a pollster, that creates a new opportunity, is not the right are taking your money and giving it to rich guys kind of factored in. The bit that is new is the Republican Party is soft on crime. Like, if you want to work out what's going on in the suburbs of American politics right now, and indeed why Joe Biden commands the kind of opinion poll numbers he currently does, it's about suburban discontent with a Republican Party that has lost its claim to order. And this is extremely dangerous for their brand, and creates a gigantic new area of political space that the left in America could potentially move into. Everyone expects the left to occupy the spaces of fairness and social justice and equality, but the actions of the Republican Party predating the insurgency, the insurrection on the 6th of January, but absolutely exemplified by it, afford the left in America the chance to take up the order space with all the extraordinary political dividends in the suburbs that could represent.
Do you see that happening right now?
I see us stumbling toward it. And I don't know if we're going, I don't know if the party is going, first of all, I mean, when you talk about the Democratic Party in America, you're talking about a huge ecosystem of organizations and independent candidates that are not particularly centrally governed. So, like, it's important to say that there isn't much in the way of a central apparatus to really develop this and propagate it if you want to. There is one. But when we talk about the Democratic Party, we're talking about a lot of different actors with a lot of different interests. So it's just sort of worth clarifying that this is not a particularly centralized institution. I see us stumbling toward it. I'm not sure we're going to get there because the fixation is on January 6th. There's a lot of talk about January 6th and what it means. A lot of talk of, you know, Republic. And the problem with this is there's a tendency for Democrats to run on, you know, January 6th was an abomination. And my opponent, I'm thinking about the upcoming congressionals, is in the pocket of Donald Trump. January 6th is a Trumpist revolution. And my opponent is in the pocket of Donald Trump or as a Trumpist. That is not the way that you can disaggregate those two things. In fact, you sort of have to disaggregate those two things, because if you're going for people who are offended by January 6th, what offends them is, to Marcus's excellent point, the affront to order. This is an orderly country. We have peaceful transfers of power. We're going to get back to doing business as usual. Most people don't want high and dramatic politics. Most people just want to get on with their goddamn lives. Excuse me, but like this is something that progressives tend to forget. Like, people just want to get the hell on with it most of the time. We want order. You know, we want an orderly transition. We want things to go back to normal. People who are affronted by the disorder of January 6th were probably at least partially drawn to Trump because he was the authoritarian, order at any cost candidate. So if you say January 6th is an affront and my opponent was an affront to order and my opponent is a Trumpist, those two things are contradictory concepts, and you're going to lose that voter. Go ahead, Marcus.
No, I was just vigorously and angrily agreeing. Like, the first point works, the second point doesn't. Attack the lack of order, attack the disorder that it represents. Don't go to the Trump space, not least of all because some of the voters who are in play if they weren't Trumpers, they were people who were content up until certain events, a la the pandemic, to allow for the president's re-election. And that's a really important fact. It may not be that they would have turned out to vote for him, but they weren't necessarily thinking of showing up to vote against him, the quiet suburb classic voter in this respect. So tackling that order point is critical here, and not getting sucked into the Trump the talk about Trump black hole is equally critical.
I have an addendum to that, because Frank just made the point that progressives often forget that people do not care about politics most of the time, and I think that is absolutely correct. And I think what's new is that Republicans forgot as well, because especially the let's call them, for simplicity's sake, Trumpist base. They are so engulfed in their identity politics stuff, more so than the left wing of the Democratic Party, which is an achievement in and of itself, that they run a gigantic risk. And I think this is a huge reason why they lost in 2020, to lose the people who want this business as usual thing. You know, if you wanted business as usual, order, stability, all the good things in 2020, you voted Biden. And now you might argue that this was a special situation because Trump was on the ballot. But what I see from the Republican Party in this year of the Lord 2021 does not seem like they are stopping the barrage of of red meat politics that is geared towards a highly energized base. But as we know all too well, a highly energized base does not win you elections. So I think there could be a confluence of factors here at work where spaces are opening up, basically, for the Democratic Party to reorient themselves towards the kind of we stand for law and order, we stand for the adult politics. You know, you just don't need to care. You know, let us run the ship of state, which has hitherto been more or less a conservative thing. You know, if you want things to continue and you don't need to engage too much with it, you usually vote CDU or you vote Tories or you vote Republicans. If you wanted to change things, you voted Democrats or SPD or Labour. But now this seems to change at least a little bit. And I mean, we had something like this, I guess, with the revolutions in the 90s, where Schröder and Blair and Clinton won office, you know, where they encroached on these spaces. They didn't take them over, but they encroached just enough to basically allow voters to give them what they needed to go over the finishing line.
I want to make one quick clarification of what I said earlier. It's not my contention that people don't care about politics, that most people don't care about politics. They do. But the way that they want to engage with politics is not to have it on fire and jumping on their head, as has been the case in America, this sort of superheated case of histrionic politics that's been the case in America for the last, you know, I mean, you can make the at least 5 years, you can make the argument that it's been going on a lot longer than that. So I'd be interested in Marcus's thoughts on your question, but I want to issue that clarification. People do care about politics, but their engagement with it needs to, and often quite passionately, but their engagement with it needs to be in a somewhat more regular and predictable way and not in this kind of like, you never know when it's going to go absolutely buck wild at any given moment. Any, you know, each day could be crazier than the last kind of way. It's exhausting.
Yeah, I'd say to you, your point, Stefan, that the left could learn in this respect from Ronald Reagan, who was very good at practicing what he called an and not a but. Instead of making a choice, or even worse, forcing voters to make a choice, a Reagan approach to the extraordinary civil liberties, human rights, equality and equity experience that America is currently undergoing would not be to say we are the party of law and order or we are the party of racial justice, but to say you can't have law and order without justice and you can't have justice without law and order. Now, that might sound trite at first, but it isn't to a voter. Indeed, it's fundamental common sense that the law and order system is not going to work if large portions of the population are being totally and completely mistreated. Equally, it's not going to work in terms of law and order if you have a Republican Party that, whether it comes to coronavirus mandates and safety protocols, or indeed an armed insurrection against the US Capitol itself, is not seen to be promoting order itself. And so there's an opportunity here, I think, for the left to take a bigger, broader, more expansive politics. And that isn't to simply say, now we're going to go and hug a cop. It's rather to actually make a challenging argument about police reform at the same time as totally denying the Republicans the ability to ever come close to the order argument. It is possible to walk and chew and gum at the same time here, not because it is complicated or additive, but because it appeals to a voter's fundamental understanding in their heart of an and not a but.
And I think Marcus is probably seeing this in his own data, but this, I mean, it's very clear that that notion that you can't have law and order without racial justice is, like, this is not radical stuff now. That is legitimately a mainstream American opinion. And to not use that is to not use it in that way is it would be political malpractice, which we very well might commit. But it's pretty clear that's the case. And Stefan, to your earlier point about whether Republicans have sort of forgotten, have kind of lost touch with the way people want to talk about politics, it is worth pointing. I think there is truth in that. I just sort of want to point out, it used to be that the Democratic Party was the party that liked to explain stuff. What do you stand for? Well, let me explain this particular piece of policy or this particular view. And if you're, you know, as Marcus is wont to say, and he's right, if you're explaining, you're losing. Now, what does the Republican Party stand for? Well, let me explain to you about the steal. You know, I've got this insane. It's like the meme of Charlie Day from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia standing in front of his conspiracy board wall with bits of yarn and like marker going everywhere. You know, this, the way that the Republican Party explains their policy platform looks like someone who has been, with respect to two gentlemen who are in a basement, it sounds like someone who's been in a basement with, you know, putting together a board of their giant conspiracy. And voters don't want to listen to someone explain to them how a presidential election was stolen when it clearly was not. If your party's entire thesis is, or your entire political messaging plan is to piss on people's leg and tell them it's raining, you've got a problem.
That is a very good point. Thank you. I have seen there was this one Fox News bit where they had a whiteboard in the background that was scribbled full, like from some conspiracy thriller.
Glenn Beck and Fabian Society.
Society. It's incredible stuff. And this has been in the bloodstream of the right for a decade because of that, right? Glenn Beck and the Fabian Society, right? Like, this has been part of their fringe communication for a long time, but it's moved out of the fringe. It's now the mainstream way they communicate. It's like they have this, it's like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, except it's the Republican Cinematic Universe. They've got this like vast collection of characters, all of whom interact and no one has ever heard of before, all of whom interact in unpredictable and inexplicable ways. And in order to buy into their politics, you have to believe all of it and understand all of it. It's repellent.
Oh, and it's even better because they're making the same mistake that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is making, which is they're going into parallel universe storytelling. Yes. And they're imagining voters or viewers are going to follow them down those paths when it is hard enough to track a single timeline, let alone a multiple branching one. And yet with Trump is about to become president again in August. We're already living in this parallel universe, which isn't just, as Frank says, about their fringe messaging. It's about a core part of the mainstay of their messaging. And now it is them who are explaining. And if you're trying to work out why they're losing, that's kind of it. And it is extraordinarily telling that what props up the contemporary Republican Party is a series of 250-year-old statutes, regulations of Senate protocol that are not in the Constitution, as well as a crazy division of powers with regard to census appropriating, redistricting. All of these things are institutional, bureaucratic, or legislative, or legal, or even constitutional bulwarks to the total loss of Republican power. They're not in a normal system of democracy anything that would result in anything other than a dramatic and extraordinary rejection of that by the electorate. I mean, what was the margins of the House? You have to go back to, what is it, Frank? 2014, for the last time the Republicans actually won a majority of votes for that.
I mean, since 1988, since 1999, they won the popular vote for president once. So this is incredible. But I want to leave the United States for our last segment here, because luckily for us, in the developed world, the conditions that you guys have are still the exception. I mean, the UK is getting there, France is making an attempt, and Eastern Europe is already well gone. But at least some democracies are left standing in a more normal fashion, if you allow me to say. And I would return to what Marcus just said about the end, not but, I think it was. Because we have the same thing here in Germany right now, not with regards to racial justice and law and order, but we do have it with environmental protection. And this is mostly due, I think, because the Greens are the runner-ups that everyone is concerned with towards the Conservative Party. And so naturally, the environmental issues play a bigger role than the social justice issues do in the US, because that's just a party id, basically. But what I see is the CDU constantly framing, and with a regularity that suggests that is internal messaging a protocol, basically. They are constantly messaging, we have to do climate protection measures, like it's important, but we have to do it in a way that is compatible with a healthy first world economy. That's their line, basically, you know. Yes, climate protection is necessary and important, but we have to think of jobs first. Yeah. So this is classic conservative stuff. And I think what the left needs to do and what they are trying, basically, is to argue that you cannot make this a but. You have to combine both. You know, you cannot have a healthy economy with jobs if you get flash floods, if you get droughts that kill everything, and so on and so forth. You know, if the climate is going to shit, we won't have an economy anymore. So this is not actually a decision between two options, A and B, but we rather need both, more or less. I'm not sure how successful they are yet, but the events in Germany in the past days, as of this recording, which is on the 19th of July, we had extreme floods in the western part of Germany that killed nearly 100 people, and that wreaked havoc. And as fate would have it, that havoc was wreaked in the home state of the CDU chancellor candidate, Armin Laschet, who is the favorite to win and who had an extraordinarily good run these past few weeks, as the Greens were just hobbled in the polls, were just beset by totally self-inflicted wounds. Think Hillary Clinton, just worse, basically. It was really harsh. And I think now we have the CDU having this problem of normally arguing like, we are the guys, when we are in power, you can safely give us power and everything will run smoothly, because this is just who we are. You know, no experiments, everything is going as it always went, there will be no rapid changes. And now you get this catastrophe, and it might just change the conversation. It might. And I would ask you what you think is the correct approach here that the Greens would take. What would you counsel them if you were actually counseling them?
Just concluded a piece of work with partners around the world. It's part of the Global Progress Network, the Center for American Progress in the US, Das Progressive Zentrum in Berlin. And the findings were on post-pandemic politics. So we looked at the G7 plus Australia, and amongst the battery of questions we asked was how people felt about new spending priorities. And they basically felt, on a partisan basis, yes, no for new spending. We asked people about how they felt on the big issues, social justice, racial equality, climate change, preventing another pandemic, etc. And there, this is telling and important to your point, Stefan, voters were telling us in Germany, in the UK, in the US, in France, in Italy, in Spain, in Australia, in Canada, they were telling us that voters will the ends without willing the means. In other words, progressives globally are winning the argument around these are more important things. But voters, when it came to choices as to who they're going to trust with this politics to do something about it, they were quite liking the right, with the notable exception of America, actually, in this respect. What does that tell us? It tells us that the left should be in no mood to celebrate when catastrophe happens, for obvious reasons, but also should not expect voters to turn to the left in the wake of even environmental catastrophe. Why is that? And a good example of that is this. If the left shows up and says, here's my 100 billion euro plan for addressing climate change, and the right shows up and says, here's my 10 billion euro plan for addressing climate change, the voter will choose the right's climate change plan over the left's. Why? Because the left has cited a crazy number, and B, because the right at least seem to care about it, so they're going to do something, and C, the right will spend that money better, that 10 billion better, than the left will spend that 100 billion. So unless the left can think about how it's not just going to win the framing argument, to take us back to the beginning of this discussion, but the problem solution part as well, and own responsibility and reasonableness within that also, then I think the left will have a problem even when it comes to addressing so-called favorable ground.
I think one of the challenges, I have very limited good advice for the Greens, in fact, maybe none at all, but I think one of the challenges that's popped up in climate change politics is that, to go back to tropes, which is clearly my favorite theme for this conversation, the right has a really strong, has two strong tropes on their side for when they, when for their, for example, $10 billion plan. That's a, Marcus, it's a terrific formulation. The $100 billion plan for the $10 billion plan. Part of it also is that humans, like the human brain just doesn't process those numbers especially well. We have a hard time figuring out what they mean. So sure, 10's better than 100, I guess. Like it just, you know, our, the way progressives use numbers and kind of depend on numbers as if they're going to mean anything to the audience at all, it's just, there's either a big number, there's a big number and a smaller number there, and that's all it really means. If we try to justify why 100 is better than 10, it's that, that's where we fall down. But also the right, but to get back to it, the right has two tropes on their side. The first is there's still the tree hugging, the you know, the starry eyed, you know, good in the heart, soft in the head tree hugger. Who's gonna stamp out, you know, who's bless them, their heart might be in the right place, but they're just gonna screw everything up. They're gonna make it impossible to make a living. And like they're just gonna throw up, they're gonna chain themselves to the trees and, you know, bedeck themselves with spotted owls or whatever, another endangered species, and we're not gonna be able to get anything done around here, right? That's one trope. And that trope is beginning to decay, but it's still a viable trope in American politics, and I suspect probably international politics as well. The other one is the profligate progressive. Right, like, and that's the, and they continue to wield, and despite 20 years of the record of right of center parties on economy, longer, 40, 50, you're now in our fifth decade of this stuff in some places, and sort of doing politics within their consensus, the profligate progressive is still there, like the trope that makes the, that, you know, that they wield most effectively and most unconsciously and casually against us to great effect. Because again, they'll spend, to Marcus's excellent point, they'll spend their $10 billion better than we'll spend their $100 billion. The mere fact that we're asking for $100 billion shows you how profligate we really are. And as a sort of international political movement, we struggle to conjure up our own trope. Who is the hero of our story here? Who is our enemy? Who doesn't want? Why is the, you know, why does someone want us to spend $10 billion instead of $100 billion? And why? Who benefits? So who is the trope that is, that we're working against? And who are we here? You know, who is our hero? What trope are we playing into? And we haven't conjured a particularly good answer for that.
So my solution here is to drop the numbers altogether. And just talk about the change that you propose to make in people's real lived experiences. Talk about, point to the physical flood defense that needs to be built, or the plane that needs to be left fallow, because these are the realities of our environment. Talk about the childcare center and the class size that the parent will experience after the change that you've made, not about the cost and not even about the spending mechanism for the taxation mechanism for the cost, aside from Frank's wave of the hand, repeal the X tax cuts position. And then, and this is critical for the Greens, I would say, and I'll close with this, with regard to what they can do now is they've got the TV debates coming up. And I think it was you, Stefan, who was pointing out to me privately previously, just how much those TV debate topics are out of kilter with German public opinion. There's going to be yet another discussion about the LGBT plus rights. There's going to be yet another discussion about supposedly inflated CVs for political candidates. In all of these instances, the opportunity for the Greens is to say the political establishment and the media are in cahoots. They're together and they're talking about anything that isn't your priority. We, the Greens, know about your family, know about your community. We care about your money. We care about your environment. We care about your job and your pay. And we're going to be focused laser-like on those things that actually matter to you. And in this respect, you can actually be more of a political insurgent. You can finally stop being an establishment politician who's talking about policy or engaging in political ephemera, and you can paint the establishment parties and the establishment media that are running these TV debates with these ridiculous focuses as part of the same political media complex, the same way that successful political insurgents of the right and the far right have been doing for years. But now you can do it from the other way around.
The problem with this is that we're too late, because the CDU and FDP have been doing this for 2 or 3 years now. We had this year alone at least 2 or 3 months of vigorous debate of how the media is all in the pockets of the green of the Greens, basically. By now, in the German public, the media, at least the public media, like what would be the BBC in the United Kingdom, or what would be CNN in the United States, or NBC, something like that, they are considered to be basically partisan media. So this doesn't work anymore. The right beat us to it, because unlike the Greens, they are much better at this. Once again, we're coming down to this problem. But I think Frank wanted something to add.
I just also wanted to sort of to highlight and build on something Marcus said, which was to get rid of numbers altogether. I couldn't agree with that more. The advice I consistently give to candidates is stop using numbers altogether, and stop explaining how you're going to pay for things. If you need to make people think you have done your homework, which can be helpful, have one simple solution that may or may not add up because no one is going to care. So for example, I was doing a statewide race, and the candidate was considering putting out a universal childcare platform. And the question was, how are we going to pay for it? It's pretty clear that the state was about to legalize recreational cannabis. Just say you're going to pay for it with that. No one cares if the numbers are going to add up. We didn't end up taking that position, but that's a really good inclination. That's a really good indication of how to talk about this. And to get back also to that point of how are you going to change people's lives? What is the specific thing that you're going to rebuild? What is the thing that you're going to build? Get away from the numbers and move into specific change in people's lives. Progressives need to be comfortable committing to outcomes. We are going to give you some childcare up in here. Like, we are going to build a childcare center, or there will be new childcare center, or there will be new businesses. What we do when we use these large, one of the reasons that we're sort of addicted to throwing around these large numbers is that those are just output. Those are not outcomes. Those are outputs. Or even inputs into the system. And as a result, it's very hard to be held accountable for them. You can go back for re-election. This is a very cynical way of putting it, but there's a truth to this. You can go back to a constituency and ask for re-election. If you have actually accomplished nothing, but you have, or at least apparently nothing, but you have, you know, passed legislation that that got $300 billion for something. We did, you know, we're coming back to you because we passed legislation that put $300 billion into the American economy for this thing. And the answer, yeah, and you know, they put $300 billion into the American economy for this thing. Did you actually create any jobs? Is anyone's life any different? Well, then what are you talking about here? And progressives don't like to commit to those kind of specific outcomes because it seems like we're overpromising, or it's irresponsible, or we know that the world is a complex place and maybe we can't deliver all that stuff. If you're trying to get into government and you're not willing to promise an outcome, what business do you think you are in?
All excellent points. I think at this point, I cannot add anything of quality. I do not have a follow-up question. Thank you guys so much for doing this once again. I really hope our listeners are enjoying it as well. Please let us know. I'm enjoying these talks greatly, and I'm learning so much from you. So once again, thank you, and have a nice day, everyone.
That's a pleasure. Thanks, Stefan.
We love hanging out with you, Stefan. Be well. Thanks a lot.